Off the coast of San Luis Obispo County, and we've got a really full agenda this evening, so we're going to jump in. One of the first things that we do is go around and have people take a minute or two to give quick updates on things that aren't on the agenda, so that we can be sure that people have a chance to update one another on things that they're aware of that are going on or that are important to share. My name is Don Maruska. I serve as the independent facilitator for the Marine Interest Group, and delighted that you're all here and listening in. You can go to the website if you wish to get additional information. We're doing some further updates on it, and this is the website location that you can check out to get additional information about the program. So with that said, Dean, do you want to kick off and we'll go around and hear from each of you?
Hello, I'm Dean Wendt from Cal Poly.
Okay, so I did it properly. And so Dean Wendt from Cal Poly Marine Sciences, and my update, brief update, is that SLOC, the San Luis Obispo Ecosystem Science and Ecosystem Alliance, one of the projects that we're working on is understanding the habitat in the bay and then also in the new marine protected area. And to that end, we've had Rick Kvitek from CSU Monterey Bay down, and he's done some bathymetry and habitat mapping inside the bay relatively recently. And then he did the Point Bouchon marine protected area, and he's back in the harbor right now, and they are doing the reference site of the Point Bouchon area, which is the area north of Point Bouchon up to Hazards Canyon, Hazards Reef, and so there he's mapping that area, and then he's also going to revisit the mouth of the harbor, and the reason for that is that it was dredged since the last time he did it, and we want to see how quickly things change back. And so there were some very interesting features, bottom features there, that he's going to go back, hopefully, if he has time, and survey that area again so that we can see how quickly things change back or how much they change in a given amount of time at the harbor mouth. And some of that's really important for later modeling work that's going to look at flow in the bay. So that's the quick update from one of the SLOC projects.
Great. Deborah Stakes, who's recently joined us as a member of the Marine Interest Group from Cuesta College.
I'm getting some remedial training on microphone technology here. Yes, I'm the newest member. I'm now the official Cuesta College representative. I have been at Cuesta College for a year and a half, and this semester we're teaching an oceanography course, and we have, I hope to include a lot of the slow sea data and some of the other data. And the oceanography students at Cuesta are very interested in including what's happening locally in their classes. And the other big news is that Cuesta and the estuary signed an MOU, for a cooperative agreement, so we're going to share lab space with some of the estuary personnel to support their research.
Great. Great. Ray Fields from the Abalone Farm.
Now it's on? Okay. Yeah, Ray Fields, president of the Abalone Farm. And the only update I have that's probably of interest to some people is we have completed our second year of work with the Nature Conservancy, kind of a joint effort on studying the effect of kelp harvesting on the settlement of juvenile rockfish. And they leased a kelp bed up off of Cambria, and we've been working with them a couple of years now, so they should be publishing that data late this year, early next year.
So that's with the Nature Conservancy?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's about it.
All right, thank you. Harry Pontarelli from the Audubon.
Moracosta Audubon Society on November 9th. Actually, Audubon is celebrating its 40th year this year. The organization was formed in 1967 to monitor peregrine falcons on Moro Rock, and we're celebrating our 40th year. November 9th from 5 to 8, we're going to have a party, a 40th anniversary celebration at our new office on the second floor, Marina and the Embarcadero, 610. Embarcadero?
601.
601, Embarcadero. Everyone's invited. It's open to the public. It's free of charge. On the business plan front, Lisa Wise Consulting, we're preparing a business plan for the commercial fisheries in Port San Luis and Walla Bay. Draft one and two of four chapters, drafts for chapter one and two have been submitted. We're working on chapter three, but we've become a little bit distracted in moving the EFP process forward. You will hear a little bit about that tonight, and there's going to be one stage of the process that's going to culminate in San Diego in November, so we're trying to help that process along. And that's about it. You'll hear more about that this evening.
Carolyn Moffitt, the Commissioner of Port San Luis Harbor District.
Good evening, all. I'm Carolyn Moffitt from Port San Luis Harbor District, and I have several things that I'd like to share with you tonight. Our facilities manager, Steve McGraw, worked with the support and encouragement of Coast National Bank to win a very significant grant, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't tell you the exact amount, and so much it just blows my mind. From the historical branch of the State Library, the amount is enough to complete the restoration of the lighthouse, providing a project manager for that, so it's just going to be a wonderful thing. I think I mentioned to you last time that we had cobbled together the money and had the permits for the road to the lighthouse, and that is going forward. So by springtime, we're going to be in the process of finalizing that facility for the public. Another item that I'd like to share with you, our operations manager, Casey Nielsen, has been representing the Harbor District at the State Harbor Masters Association, and this year he was granted the State Harbor Manager of the Year Award, and that's a very significant award, and the harbor managers of major ports and harbors throughout California select one of their own for this honor, and Casey was recognized. One other item that I'd like to share is a safety award that we've received. Special District Risk Management Authority as the insuring arm of the Special Districts Association. We received the safety award. It's the Earl F. Sayer Property and Liability Safety Award for Excellence. And this is more than just a recognition, because with this comes a very substantial discount in the cost of our insurance, like about 15%. And so this means a lot to the port Locke Dresler received that for the Harbor District in Sacramento. So I thank you very much, and I'll pass it along.
Okay, thank you. Dennis Peters, the mayor of Morro Bay.
Hello. Couple things. First, I'm going to take off my mayor hat and put on my bird festival hat. Our annual Winter Bird Festival is coming up next January, and those of you who are interested in that ecological environmental event, we have brochures available at the Chamber of Commerce. And sign-ups are starting now. What's going on in Morro Bay? We did, as a council, approve the idea of the ships to reefs and endorse them going ahead with their research on doing that in our area. We're working on our boardwalk. If you've been out to the Rock lately, you'll see that there's a different road out there, and we're hoping that that's going to be a real advantage to our visitors to have a pedestrian and bicycle area close to the water where they don't have to compete with the vehicles. We also have our ice plant is open and available to our fishing industry and also anybody else that needs ice. It's a big plant. We got a lot of ice available. So if you're having a big party, come on by the harbor office and let us know. And I think that's about it.
Okay, thank you. Kirk Stern, who's an alternate today for Dave Sears.
Good evening, Don. One hat tonight for the Port San Luis Harbor District, and then another hat for most of the meeting with Dave Sayers, and I'll pass on updates.
Hi, I'm Dan Berman with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. A couple updates from the estuary program in Morro Bay. We've conducted our first flush sampling that we do with staff and volunteers every year during the first rain events of the year. We sample stormwater inputs into the bay, storm drains along the Embarcadero and in Los Osos. We're just starting to get the results back. We test for bacteria, heavy metals, primarily, and I think within a month or so we'll have a full kind of report written up with this year's findings, and that'll be available on our website. We're also gearing up for our fall annual sampling of the eelgrass beds in the bay. We've had folks out on the ground collecting data out in the field for ground truthing, and then in mid-November, so we're going to have some flights, weather permitting, over the bay, taking some really detailed high-resolution pictures of the bay, and that'll get turned into a map and a measurement of the acreage of eelgrass. Other thing in the bay, been talking with the Department of Health Services that works with the oyster growers to certify the safety of the oyster beds, and they're monitored very closely, and they are fine. The oysters that are sold are fine, but they have been struggling with some areas where they would like to have oysters being restricted due to high bacteria levels. One of the things they're talking about, and it's not for sure yet, but is the possibility of doing a dye tracking study in the bay to really get a much better measurement of circulation patterns in that part of the bay where the oyster growers are. So I'll be working with some of the folks here and others to coordinate with that study. And then I'll just mention, I know I just got an update. There's a moving up to sort of the whole West Coast scale. The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington have been working together on a, they're calling it a West Coast Governor's Agreement, to talk about the coastal ocean for the whole West Coast. And they just recently put out a draft kind of action plan that they're looking for comments on. So folks who are interested in coastwide environmental issues of the ocean, it tackles things like non-point source pollution, marine debris, and how to coordinate better across state boundaries and other kind of jurisdictional boundaries. It's a pretty good thing to take a look at and comment on. I think comments are due maybe December or so, so you've got about a month to check that out. And if you searched for Ocean Protection Council online, you'd find your way to that. And I think that's about it for me.
Okay. One update that I have to share is that a number of you participated last week in discussions with the Resource Legacy Fund Foundation with Mike Weber and Sylvia Troust. They were in town because they're very interested in this area and have been supporting a number of initiatives here, the Collaborative Fisheries Research Program that we've had underway, and they're also a significant funder of the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance. I know that Mike Weber, who's the program officer, came away from those discussions with a real positive sense of how this community is working together to address issues and how effective and constructive you all are being in doing that. And I wanted to announce that they have agreed to provide support for the Marine Interest Group for 2008. So I know we have as an agenda item for later in the meeting a discussion about the future of the MIG. There's still some issues to discuss about the role you'd like it to play and what issues you'd like to be addressing as we continue to evolve the organization. But for 2008, the funding issue has been addressed. And I think that that reflects their continued and sincere interest in this area. One of the things I want to highlight about the nature of their support, which I think is very distinctive, and it also reflects the history of the evolution of the Marine Interest Group, which originally was supported with funds from the World Wildlife Foundation. And while both of these are environmental groups, they've taken the position of really a hands-off approach with regard to the agenda items that are discussed here, the directions that are taken by this group, and they've really had a magnanimous approach of saying that they believe that when stakeholders come together and thoughtfully reflect on the information that's available and share their insights, that they will do the right thing. So never in any of the agendas or anything else that we've ever pursued here with the Marine Interest Group have any of those funding organizations exerted any influence or direction about what's covered or how, what we talk about, what we don't talk about, who's involved or who isn't. And I think that that's just a great statement about them, and I think it's a great statement about all of you that they put that trust in you. So I wanted to acknowledge that support. I thought it might be nice if you'd like to write a note, if you wish, and I'll pass a card around, and you can do that, because some of these folks, like Mike Weber and Sylvia Trust, really have, at a personal level, you know, stepped out to support this community and are looking forward to doing that again in the future, and we certainly want to encourage that. So good news on that front. So with that said, we're on to some letters and other communications. We've got two items down here, a brief update on the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program. This is an effort that was really spawned, if you will, by the Marine Interest Group, which was literally an initiative that began in Denny's restaurant. Well, actually, before that, it began on the waterfront in Port San Luis, where fishermen said, "Hey, if we know where the fish are, if you just let us show you, we can show you what's happening, and we can get better data and research." And so Dean Wendt and other researchers, and I, and Marla, and Bob Hather, and other folks got together and said, "Well, how can we make this happen?" And that was the beginning of the collaborative research project, which is now 3 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So the next extension of that has been the creation of the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program, which is now what Dean's going to report on briefly, which is the next generation of this collaborative work, which is even more closely linked to the Department of Fish and Game and to NOAA Fisheries, and developing key information about the stock assessments that are so critical to the fisheries here. So Dean, an update about what people have been doing this summer.
Yeah, thank you. I don't have much of an update for you. I have a couple pretty pictures to show you, and I'll direct you to a website to get more information. I have also printed off, and we probably should have handed these out, several flyers from the website about if you get a tagged fish, and then some summaries of a couple months of work. But
let's put the tagged fish item up here, because we can really use the public's help.
And I want to be quick about this.
When they find tagged fish to, and I guess we have to push this, right, for source?
Great. So, as Don mentioned, this is a program that grew out of the work originally of the Marine Interest Group and the collaborative research that is ongoing still with the CPFV industry and also with the nearshore commercial trap fishermen. But this program, the California Collaborative Fisheries Research Program, is the next step in that we're using fishermen and skippers and their knowledge to help study the marine protected areas and to determine how effective those marine protected areas are with fish populations. And so this is a flyer that's on a website that I'll direct you to in a moment, that's just saying, if you've seen a tagged fish, make sure that you get a hold of the people down at the bottom of this flyer, and there are two of the technicians that are running this program. And so just as a public service announcement, if you see a tagged fish and it says call Cal Poly or call folks up in Monterey, make sure that you do that, because it's really important for the data that we're going to be collecting. So is there any way we can toggle back now? That would be great. Thank you. So, as a very quick summary, as I said, this group is a collaboration with several entities. We're working with the fishermen in Port San Luis and out of Morro Bay, with Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance in this area, and then we're connecting our protocols and efforts over a much broader geographic area than we have before. And we're working with the fleet up in Monterey and connecting with scientists up at Moss Landing Marine Labs and Sea Grant to execute this project. And so it's pretty extensive in the geographic coverage. This is a figure of the marine protected areas. Right now, the funding we have allows us to sample three marine protected areas, and so we are sampling two up in the north right now and then one in the south, as well as reference sites for each of those. So we're looking at Año Nuevo, Point Lobos Marine Reserve, and then Point Bouchon. We'd like to also be working in Piedras Blancas in our area, but the funding is limiting that right now. And the group has been out all for the last 3 months. We started in August, and we've been out sampling a total of 36 days now across the whole area since the start of the program. And so we're working in those areas right now, and what we're producing right now, it can be found on a website, but we're sort of summarizing the data in these flyers. I have some of them here, but they're also available on a website on the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance website. So you can go to www.sloc.org, and if you click on Collaborative Fisheries, that'll get you a series of documents that you can download, and the most recent results, which is really a compilation at this point of the species we've caught, the number of fishes that we've tagged, and where those fishes were captured. And so we've tagged up to this point several thousand fish. By the end of the season, which will be ending this month, so very soon, we will probably have tagged around 10,000 fish. And this is forming the baseline for future years of monitoring. And so we have limited funding right now for this particular year, and what we hope to do is continue this and to develop it into a long-term data set. And something that's really important about this is that at the outset, we've worked very closely with the resource managers at NOAA Fisheries and California Department of Fish and Game to make sure the protocol we're using is going to feed into their management process. And so that's a little different than what we've done before with this group, where we adapted a protocol that was done before and then tried to deliver the data to the resource managers. And they've used it to some degree, but they were interested in things being done a little bit differently. And so this time we took care of that at the outset because we were able to design this from the ground up. And so ultimately these data are going to the state, and they're going to be used in the assessment of the marine protected areas, and they're going to the federal government as well to be used in stock assessments. And so that's a really quick, brief update on that particular program.
Okay, great. Just a couple other things to highlight. I think the major thing here is that we've extended the range of this research now, going not only in the area of Port San Luis and Morro Bay, but on up through Año Nuevo up in San Mateo County. So it's now in a much larger region that's more consistent with the kind of management areas that DFG and Fish and Game and NOAA Fisheries look at. And so this is beginning to form a foundation, which you'll see is linking in with a discussion that's going to come up in a little bit about developing the concept of regional management of fisheries, by getting regional data to support such regional management. Right now, the databases and the models that NOAA Fisheries use are the whole coast, western coast. They don't have data by regions, and therefore they're not really able to think about how to manage by region. This data is going to help create a foundation for being able to think about how to manage by region, because many people have argued that this area, you know, the fish in this area are more abundant, different characteristics than fish in other parts of the coastline. So we're creating an important building block here that I think is very significant for that overall program that links into several initiatives you're going to hear about tonight. So I just wanted to highlight that under that element of it. Any quick question or comment for Dean? Okay. All right, thanks. So our other brief update is about the California Ships to Reefs Coalition and the discussions that they've had with the community. At the last meeting that we had in June, they reported on their plans with regard to this and their intention to hold community meetings. We're not seeking at this marine interest group meeting to reproduce those community meetings, but rather to hear from them on and to update the members of the marine interest group on what's been heard from the community about this, sort of where that project stands, and sort of what's next. So okay. I think Kirk and
Rick
are going to be sharing that story.
Thank you. Dawn, on Thursday, September 27th, Rick and I hosted a public workshop regarding the Ships to Reef. About 55 people attended, including the Morro Bay City Council, Port St. Louis Harbor Commissioners, County Supervisor Jerry Linthal, representatives from Lois Capps, Sam Blakesley, and Abel Maldonado's office, dive shop owners, interested citizens, one or two people from the environmental community, and Ships to Reef representatives. The purpose of the meeting was for Rick and I to gather public input about the Ships to Reef concept so Rick and I could take the matter forward to our elected officials. During the workshop, we gathered public information on the following topics. First, step one, we asked if anybody was missing from the process, and we read a list of names of people that we talked to and then invited the 55 people to give us feedback on people that we missed so far in our informal context. And we missed Cal Poly, we missed Cuesta College, we missed the Surfrider Foundation and a couple of other groups, so we've got homework to do. Next is we asked a series of questions and gave 3x5 cards to the participants and collected the 3x5 cards for each question. And it was phrased like this. We didn't ask people to support the Ships to Reef concept. We said, in order for you to support this, what additional information would you need on? And then we went through a series of questions. And one of the questions was about the site itself. And so people raised issues about what is the location, are there constraints, are there areas to avoid, are there areas to investigate about possible places that this could work. Next question, about the actual activities at the site. Is it diving only? Is it fishing only? Is there mixed use? Is there habitat? What are the operational concerns for us to look at? Next, and an important topic, what about the cleaning of the vessels? What about the environmental concerns? And we received a lot of good input on things to consider, like what are the standards? Who owns the standards? Are there differing standards between the state, between the federal government, between branches of the federal government? Who does the work and where does the work occur were things we should follow up on. We then listed the regulatory agencies, and we know we don't have them all, but examples are the Coast Guard, NOAA, Fish and Game, Coastal Commission, Water Resources Control Board, county planning, local planning, to name a few, are examples of the people that would be involved in a regulatory process if it goes forward. And then the process itself would be shaped around something regarding in the CEQA process, and people brought up issues of segmenting. You know, are you going to put in more than one ship? And if you do, are you going to plan for the whole area or plan for one ship, et cetera? And I'd like to have Rick give just a brief update on what's occurred since our meeting in September with the city of Morro Bay.
I think the mayor gave the city of Morro Bay City Council in September passed a resolution of support for the process in concept, just as you described. And so we're working on the ironing out the bugs and forming groups, seeing how the details will work out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner Moffitt, we had a discussion last night at the port.
The Harbor District did not pass a resolution of supporting this last night, but we tabled it for further consideration. We're concerned, or we're looking to understand better how this project will impact other projects that we have time-wise, staff demands, those kinds of things, and we'll be looking at this again.
Right. Okay. So our next steps, number one, to keep the MIG informed. Next is there's a couple of videos that are out on the tables, and I tried to place them with people that I know haven't seen it before. The video has three parts to it. The first part is an information about a similar project down in Southern California called the Yukon, which is about a third of the tape. Another third of the tape involves just all the environmental considerations that go into the project. And then the last third of the video is the primary purpose of these activities are tourism-based and not necessarily habitat, but there is a habitat component. And so it lists the monitoring that goes on at the sites and how about 50% of the diving that occurs there are volunteer divers that assist with the monitoring of the habitat from the second that it goes down into the future. So, okay. Dawn, I think that's about it.
Okay. I'm wondering if Mayor Peters, you might share with us, since the city did pass a resolution of support for this process, if you would indicate what were some of the things that the city of Morro Bay elected officials found attractive about this and sort of what was the thinking there. I think that would help inform people about, you know, how you're considering this opportunity.
Well, it was interesting because, of course, our first concern is it environmentally safe? And one of our council members even said, you know, I came prepared to have all these questions and concerns, and they answered every single one. So obviously the people that are behind this project have really done their homework. They've actually been doing this already, so they can speak with authority as to what the effect is or non-effect is of doing this. And the thing that ultimately I found very attractive about it is that not only is it recycling material that otherwise we would have to pay for storing, but it also is bringing life from that material in that it does create habitat for so many different marine species. And I just think that's exciting, that you're not only recycling something, but you're having it work for the good of the environmental aquaculture, is it? So that was basically, we really didn't see anything wrong with it. We wanted to make sure that they're cleaned up properly, obviously, but that seemed to be part of the deal. So we were very impressed with the presentation and the thoroughness of the whole project idea.
Any brief questions for Kirk or Janice or Carolyn or Rick? Okay. Well, we have, that's it for the updates at the moment. We've got four key topics for this evening that were topics selected by the Marine Interest Group at its last meeting that it wished to have addressed in more detail. The first one is the Coastal User Survey, a preliminary report on the Morro Bay Socioeconomic Study. Then we're going to have an update on the Sustainable Fisheries Project and consideration by the MIG of an expression of support for that. Then the environmental conditions of the Central Coast Harbors, report from both the Regional Water Quality Control Board and from the Slow Sea Monitoring. And then the response that the Marine Interest Group received at the Fish and Game Commission to the Owl Limpets petition that was submitted, and we even have a bit of the tape from the Fish and Game Commission meeting that we can look at if there's time, and then we'll conclude with a discussion about topics of interest to you next time and the evolving role of the Marine Interest Group. So that's what's on deck. We're having the first presentation be about the Coastal User Survey. This is Lexi Brown, a UCSB graduate student who was here in the community for a big part of this summer, weren't you, Alexi?
Yeah, I was here.
We're recording this. You can sit down.
Here, you can sit here, actually. You want to sign the card?
Hi, everyone. Yes, I was here this summer from the end of June all the way through Labor Day weekend. So I was here for most of the summer collecting our data. Thank you for inviting us to come and tell you about our survey that we've done this summer, and hopefully we'll continue in the future with San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance. My name is Lexi Brown. As Don mentioned, I'm a graduate student at UCSB Santa Barbara, and I am at the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. And with me is another graduate student, Brianna Flanagan. And with two other students, we're working on this project as our thesis in conjunction with the SLOC group. You may have heard of Allison Chan and Linwood Pendleton. They work with SLOC under the Economic Indicators Initiative, the purpose of which is to establish a baseline of ecosystem-dependent business activities in Morro Bay. So to help them reach that goal, we developed a coastal user survey, the purpose of which was to serve as a mechanism to determine how perceptions of environmental quality relate to recreational activities and expenditures in Morro Bay. And we had a few questions we really wanted to address. The first one was how people spend their leisure time in Morro Bay and which habitats they interact with mostly, what their perceptions are of environmental quality in Morro Bay, and how those perceptions compare to what they think of other ecosystems along the California coast. We wanted to know how accurate those environmental perceptions are and what the relationship is between environmental perceptions, recreational activities, and expenditures. So over time, if this survey is repeated year after year, we'll get a baseline of data of how those perceptions are changing each year and whether or not activities are changing in relationship to how people perceive the environment. So Brianna's passing out a copy of our visitor survey. We had two different surveys, a resident and a visitor survey. They were pretty much the same, except at the beginning of the visitor one, it asks about their trip, and instead on the resident one, we asked about how long they've lived here and where they live. But other than that, they're pretty much the same. And it was a two-page survey with 12 questions.
Maybe just before you jump into that, Lexi,
sure.
Just as a little bit of context here, the fundamental issues that this group is trying to address with regard to the socioeconomic survey is to see what linkage is there between a healthy ecosystem and the economy of the area, which is sort of a fundamental question. In other words, sort of what's the bottom line value, if you will, to the economy of this area, of the nature and quality of the marine ecosystem. So this is a really interesting, I think, this is really sort of the first effort, at least on the West Coast. Maybe they've done it elsewhere, but I think on the West Coast, maybe you can speak about that, to take a real rigorous look at what is the linkage between the quality of an ecosystem and the economy of the area. And this will be very helpful, we hope, you know, in future planning for the city of Morro Bay and other coastal communities in thinking about, okay, how do you leverage the environmental assets of the community to the economic benefit of the residents and businesses. So maybe you could speak some more about,
sure.
Is this the first time that this has been done or elsewhere?
As far as we know, this is the first time that anyone has looked at environmental perceptions in this way. There is a little bit of literature about environmental perceptions, but linking that to activities and to habitats has not been done as far as we know. Allison and Linwood are also working on a project in Elkhorn Slough that is similar. But it's not, they haven't developed the survey in such a rigorous fashion. They're working more with businesses and finding out how the economy is influenced by the environmental quality and sort of comparing those aspects. But this is really the first time anyone has looked at the actual people coming to Morro Bay or living in Morro Bay, the individuals, and how their perceptions influence their choices. So that's what we've been trying to look at with this survey and what we tried to develop here for you guys in Morro Bay. And we've been, our biggest goal is to give you all something that you can use to make your own decisions that you make, be it the city or a nonprofit or the National Estuarine Program, just giving them information on how the environment relates to your economy, and especially in terms of tourism and visitors. So I wanted to tell you a little bit about the survey. We developed this in the spring quarter, which was from March through June. And we did a preliminary survey. We came up here in Morro Bay. We tested it out a little bit before we went off and did it for the entire summer. And the most important question that you'll see on this page is numbers 4 and 5, which ask about the activities people do when they come to Morro Bay. So we tried to focus on activities that we thought were most popular and that were most closely related to habitats. So that was a major question that we asked. And then on the second page of the survey, question number 8 is our main environmental perception question. So we were asking people to compare Morro Bay to other similar places they've been in the central and southern California coast. And they compared five different factors: water quality, fish abundance, bird abundance, abundance of other marine wildlife, and availability of access to open spaces. And then sort of related to that question is question 11, further down the page, which asks if they've been visiting for over 5 years, if they've seen a change in their environmental quality in Morro Bay. And for the residents, we asked them if they've lived here for at least 5 years, if they've noticed a change in the environmental quality. So those are the main perception questions. And then at the bottom, you'll see the demographic questions are basically asking who is coming to Morro Bay. Hopefully we'll get some good information there, you know, how far people are traveling to get here and that sort of thing. And then the third part of the survey is a map. And this was took a lot of effort to come up with a map that we thought people could really look at. So we started out with Morro Bay, and we picked out areas that we thought people would go to the most, that we could get surveys from in a timely fashion, but also that were really related to the habitats, where people might be doing activities that are habitat-oriented. And then we picked a list of activities that were related to those habitats. So we picked birdwatching, fishing, beach-going, hiking, kayaking, wildlife viewing, watching boats, and just sightseeing. And if they didn't go there, we asked them to tell us that, and also if they'd done other activities. Some people listed, you know, horseback riding and some other things that were slightly less popular, but definitely really related to the habitats that they would visit. And so this is what the final product of the map looked like. Once you explain it to people, pretty much everyone filled it out and everything. They got a little intimidated by the map, but we got through it. And they just simply circled those letters that corresponded to the activities. So did anybody happen to take the survey? Did I run into anybody? No. Did you take it? All right. So we were in a lot of places, and we talked to a lot of people. And I wanted to tell you some of our preliminary data. Since this is our thesis project, you know, we're not full-time working on the survey, so it takes us a little while to get through everything, but we've had all our data entered and checked, and now we're working on the statistics right now, so I have a few of those things to show you. And our most exciting is that we got 686 surveys this summer, which our goal was 200 to 400, so we went way over that, so that was really exciting. And most of those were visitors, 84%, and 16% were residents. And our response rate was also, we were really pleased with that. We had over an 85% response rate, which means pretty much everyone we talked to took the survey. We didn't have too many people saying that they didn't want to take it. And then just to give you a couple of the demographics, you know, we were pretty evenly split between males and females, and the mean age was around 47.5 years. So this is a little bit more of what we found in terms of activities. This is for visitors. We wanted to show you what visitors are saying they're doing when they come to your city. And obviously a lot of people are going out to eat. That's dining there in the middle. And shopping, beach going are really popular. And also hiking or walking. So people are getting out and seeing the area around the city. And then this is the same list of activities but for residents. So you'll see that even though there's less residents, if you look at the very last bar, fishing, the proportion of residents that are fishing is more than visitors, even though there were less taking the survey. And obviously no one was camping if they lived here. But they definitely were also dining, hiking, beach going, and shopping were all the really popular ones. And this shows the total activities over both the residents and visitors. And then we wanted to show you a little bit about what people thought of the environmental quality of Morro Bay. So this is kind of, the graph's kind of small, but I just wanted you to be able to see the trends in the graphs. So if you look at your survey for that question number 8, the different choices people had were whether they thought each of these factors were better, equal, or worse than other places they've been. And then the last bar all the way to the right is that they weren't sure. So the top one is water quality. People either thought it was better here or they weren't sure. The most interesting, I thought, was fish abundance, the top right. People just weren't sure. They felt if they don't fish, they didn't know. And if they don't fish, other places, they didn't want to compare it. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And then you'll see a bird abundance most people thought was better here, which was great because I have the bird estuary, sanctuary. And then access to open space, a lot of people thought was better here than other places that they go to. And for residents, they also compared to other places along the Central and Southern California coast. And you'll see they thought everything was better here. So that's good, right? People are happy to be here. I'm sure you all already knew that because that's what you think. But thought you'd be interested in that. And then this is some information about the question 11 I told you about earlier, which was what people thought about change in environmental quality in Morro Bay over time. And we put residents and visitors on the same graph here. So the blue bar on the left is the residents. And their options from left to right were either it improved, it worsened, it hasn't changed over the last 5 years, or they weren't sure. So even though most people, you know, a lot of the over 40% of both types of respondents said it hasn't changed. But what's interesting is that if you look at the left two answers, residents were more like, more of them said that it got worse than improved. But visitors had a much greater difference, and many more of them thought it improved. The environmental quality has improved if they've been visiting. And what was interesting for me about being out doing the surveys is that a lot of people that come to your city come every year. It's their vacation spot, and they come every year, every 2 years, or they rent the same house. It's a lot of people that come back. So I thought that was pretty interesting that there's definitely a difference in perceptions between visitors and residents.
Did they indicate to you anything about why they came to those conclusions?
Not on our survey.
What was driving that? And was it a particular thing? Was it reading about the sewer in Los Osos? Was it something that was triggering their thinking, or was it an across-the-board assessment?
Well, because we're keeping it to 2 pages, we didn't ask any particular questions about that, although we're hoping that there may be some trends we can see between the previous question in different types of environmental quality and the activities, and if we can tie that to their answers in this question. But in terms of anecdotal evidence, just people talking to me as they're doing the survey, there was a couple of people that would mention the sewer thing, although I wouldn't say, you know, a majority or anything. And there is people that I think are most concerned about water quality and changes in water quality and what they read in the newspaper. But I wouldn't say any of those things were a majority of the people giving these answers. It was just sort of anecdotes of what people said as they were filling out the survey. So we did ask if environmental quality was a factor in people deciding to visit Morro Bay, and 40% of respondents said yes, it was. So they definitely come here because they think it's a good environment. And of those 40%, half of them said access to open space was the most important factor in deciding to come to Morro Bay out of those 5 factors we asked them about environmental perceptions. And we also asked if weather in their place of residence is a factor in them coming to visit. And I know that y'all think you know the answer, but 60% said yes, it is. It is a factor. That's why a lot of people come here. So as I said, this is a lot of our preliminary data, and we'll have a lot more done. We're definitely going to do a lot of neat things with the map. We're going to show spatial differentiation in the habitats and activities. So these are a couple of websites you can go to as we update our information. The Morro Bay Group Project website has both surveys on there if you want to refer to them later. And on April 2nd, we'll be doing our final big presentation in Santa Barbara, and we'll have all of our information then. So do you have any questions for me?
So questions from the Marine Interest Group or from members of the audience about this? Michael? If you just go to the microphone, they appreciate that. And this is Michael Bell from the Nature Conservancy.
So the plan is that the survey will be repeated year in and year out?
That's the idea for the Economic Indicators Initiative of SLOCI. One of our big things that we were supposed to do as the Bren Group project was figure out the methodology for the survey, where to go, how to get the right amount, so that they can repeat it in the future. So I don't know, like, specifically how many times they want to do it, or every year or every other year. But in addition, separate from SLOCI, Allison and Linwood with the Coastal Ocean Value Center are planning on implementing this similar survey in other places along the coast. I think they want to do, I know they want to do it in Elkhorn Slough and I think in Santa Monica. So it's definitely going to be, Morro Bay is like the blueprint for that. So they'll be using that.
I guess I was just wondering, is there an opportunity to modify the survey slightly or add more questions? You know, there are certain things that I saw, like a big reason people come here is access to open space. Exactly what open space are they interested in? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what, although that there is that sort of data, but just adding that to that question or other things like that, the way it could be modified.
I think there's definitely room for that, and if that's a great suggestion, we'll be using that in our report when we give to them what they should be doing in the future.
Great.
Go ahead, Rick. Or
Henry, because okay.
Henry?
I know it's early, Lexi, but you didn't describe any results from 12. Did you get anything?
We haven't gotten, but I will email you as soon as I get those results.
Thanks. You know, I'll make a comment that's sort of personal, but Lexi stayed in a spare bedroom at our house this summer, and she didn't introduce Brianna, too, but these people worked really hard. Back when I was in college, I would have done about half of what you do and probably filled out a quarter of them myself. She went every day and did these surveys. It was really amazing, so I appreciate it. And Brianna, too.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Henry, questions?
Yeah, we had the Audubon. We had the chance to share an office with Lexi and Brianna this year. We gave them access to our office, and it was a pleasure. We're glad they were there, and we hope they come back. Lexi, the bulk of the study was conducted during the summertime, during the summer season. There were plans to continue conducting a small survey as the year went on or as the season went on.
Right.
Are we going to continue with that?
I think that will happen hopefully before next summer, but there'll probably be a period of time before they can start another survey. They need to find people that aren't in Santa Barbara to do so. And also, I think that Allison and Linwood are possibly looking into doing a hotel survey as well to get, because it's hard in some places to get, like, for instance, Los Osos, we had the fewest number of respondents there just because it's harder to run into people there. So that's something that I think will be starting up perhaps later in the year.
Go ahead. Dan.
Yeah, I wanted to congratulate you. I think this is really exciting, and I think I know for the Asteroid Program, I think a lot of other folks, it's going to be really important information to have. I guess my question is about what you're envisioning, or maybe this is more a question for Allison and Linwood, in terms of a final report. I'm sure I know you're going to be writing your master's thesis, but I don't think that's necessarily going to be the format that will be most useful for us or for other folks here. Are you envisioning sort of a more concise summary report that will be available?
We'll actually do a brief for our thesis, because the way our thesis works is it's a group project, and it's the main idea is actually presenting the data, not so much the end thesis results. So we'll have a brief that we can distribute that's much shorter. But in addition, we'd really like to get the data to a point where people can go and look at the data themselves online. So I'm not sure which website we'll be able to put that up on, but we'll definitely let the MIG know and other groups in Morro Bay where you can not only find our results but our actual data if you want to, you know, look at it yourself and see the numbers that we found.
Carolyn?
Yes, I think the idea of expanding your survey into the off-season might be very helpful to the communities who would like to expand their business season into the off-season. I know Avila Beach and Morro Bay and many of the other coastal communities are very, very seasonal, and it seems like your study might provide an opportunity to enhance visitor opportunities in the off season.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to do that. And if you have any suggestions on if anything in the survey would be different for off season visitors, that'd be something that we'd like to know as well.
Maybe the age, certainly the age of the visitor would be different.
Any other questions or comments? Just strikes me that you have a lot of excellent data here that could be useful to many different groups. I'm thinking some of the promotional efforts that the city of Morro Bay is going through. You've got some great graphs and statistics in there of, you know, why come to the Morro Bay? And, you know, well, let us tell you what 686 people who visited said is the reason they came, which is really multiple reasons. So it underscores from kind of an independent point of view, that is the consumer's point of view, why come here and what is there available to do. And that might be something that could be fun and interactive to have on your website or get out in promotions or whatever else to make it credible to people about, you know, what's available here to do and what do real people do when they come here. So it seems to me a lot of resources that could be used by many people in many different ways out of what you've already come up with. So very exciting work. And we thank you for coming all the way up from Santa Barbara for this meeting to share the results. It was very kind of you to
Morro
do that.
Morro Bay. There's less ash up here.
Yes, with the fires going on. Thanks so much, Lexi and Brianna. Okay. Well, the next topic is an update about the Sustainable Fisheries Project and consideration by the MIG of an expression of support for that project. And I guess we've got Rick Algert and from Harbor Director of Morro Bay and Michael Bell from the Nature Conservancy sharing with us an update about what's happening in that project, where it stands, what's needed to move it forward, and so on.
Well, thanks everyone for having us here. As Don mentioned, my name is Michael Bell, and I'm a local project director with the Nature Conservancy, and I'm here to give an update on our exempted fishing permit project. So the exempted fishing permit, the concept of it, we've talked about it in this group before, but the concept of it is transitioning traditional trawl permits to more selective gear types, specifically hook and line and trap gear here in Morro Bay. The Nature Conservancy, from the buyout that happened a couple years ago, the Nature Conservancy now holds 7 permits. And with 6 of these permits, we are going to the council meeting in November to request that they give us an exemption from the regulation to fish these permits with this more selective gear type, and also to fish these permits within the structure of a community-based cooperative fishing association. The proposal was modified or improved drastically from June when we first presented it to the council. And we worked with all the sponsors of the proposal. Those include the Commercial Fishing of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishing Organization, the Port San Luis Commercial Fishing Organization, the harbor departments from both Port San Luis and Morro Bay, Department of Fish and Game, the Nature Conservancy, and Environmental Defense. And it's been a very collaborative effort over the last 4 months, I suppose. And the feedback we've gotten thus far from council members at the Pacific Fisheries Management Council is that it is a drastically improved proposal, the feedback, generally speaking, has been pretty positive, and so we're hoping this vote passes. What we're asking for today specifically, or requesting today specifically, is a formal letter of support from the Marine Interest Group for this project. And I hope that myself and Kirk and Rick Algert can answer any questions that the group may have or any information they may need to know in order to provide us with such a letter of support.
Okay. Rick or Kirk, did you two want to add something to the description here?
Yes. You know, there's a couple of features about this effort that we're going through. First, you know, the gear switching is unique, and it's going to be less harmful to the environment. Next is it's going to give up to 6 commercial fishermen an opportunity to fish again. Next is this community-based fishing association is a real different model, and it's going to be a model that's going to be more important in a few years. And so we have an opportunity to trial run this model of putting management at the more of the local level and letting the local fishing association manage it within the limits that's delegated down. And so this can be, we can work out the nuts and bolts of this, and in a few years, it's going to be more important to know about this because the industry is switching to that trend. So I would hope that there could be some letter of support. Last night, the Port San Luis Harbor District Commissioners voted unanimously to support this effort, and it's going to be sending people down there. And also just that this isn't a slam dunk. This is a one-year project. There's a lot of effort that's going into this to get a one-year project, and we need votes. And there's some opposition to this, but also I think the bigger picture of experimenting, trying something different, and being less harmful to the environment, hopefully those principles can override some more short-term concerns.
Rick, anything further? Okay, so comments or questions? Why don't we take first the clarifying questions? Or I guess, Henry, you've been actively involved in the development of this, and maybe you have more that you'd like to...
Yeah, I wanted to kind of make the point that as the fisheries, as designated or in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, as the fisheries move to a quota-based system, what we're doing is really trying to position ourselves or give ourselves an advantageous position to have... a good knowledge base of how the regional fishing associations are formed and how to manage quota, quote unquote quota, within a regional system, and I think putting the decision making process or handing the decision making process into a regional form addresses social equity issues where the fishermen and the community are actually making the decisions as to where we fish and when we fish and where the fish are going. We're addressing environmental issues. The quota-based system, there's less gear in the water. There's a higher safety rates under quota fisheries. And there's the economic issues as well. We've seen in the preliminary studies of the business plan moving to a higher value or a environment where the fishermen can focus on value as opposed to focusing on catch is all the forces are kind of lining up to make that come into play. So I think that supporting this effort is really putting the community in a very advantageous position.
Okay. Other comments or observations? Carolyn?
Yeah, am I on? I'd like to add my comments. We felt at the Harbor Commission last night that this is an opportunity to transition this industry into the future and restore that culture to our communities. I think it's a very important opportunity for all of us right now.
Okay. Good. Dan?
Yeah, I'm supportive of this. I think it would probably be helpful to have one of the folks, Kirk, you were just speaking real clearly about a couple of the points, one of the folks who's pretty involved in it maybe draft up a letter for us. But I guess my question is, and I know this is an incredibly complicated regulatory scheme, and I don't want to get lost myself or lose folks who are watching in the details, but I guess it seems like such a good idea from our local perspective. I'm curious if it's possible to do without getting too complex. What are the concerns and where's the opposition to this coming from? Is it from environmental community at large? Is it from fishermen from other areas? Or is it more from regulators who aren't ready to make the step towards this new approach?
Well, I think to understand the opposition, it's important to understand what Henry was talking about, and that is that the industry, the groundfish trawl industry, is going through a rationalization process right now. Essentially what that means is that permit holders will be allocated quota, a harvest share, in the annual catch. It is a pretty competitive environment right now as far as positioning to make sure that you get as much quota as possible. There's a theory out there that if these permits are inactive over a long period of time, perhaps they won't qualify for a quota allocation. And that may make some people, I'm speaking in the conditional tense here on purpose, that may make some people want us to not use our permits and not be active and not try that such an experiment. The other thing is I think this is a real concern. We're fishing in a different way. We're fishing with a more selective, more precise type of gear. And we are asking for a certain amount, an allocation of fish to go do this. That will have a legitimate impact in other fishing operations, especially in something called the Conception Area, south of 36 degrees or south of Point Sur all the way to the Mexican border. And it gets very technical and complex, but there are legitimate issues as far as how much fish we take and how much fish that will leave for other private operations to fish with over the course of a year. But I do want to say that there is a lot of support. We are testing two things here that the industry is excited about. A lot of folks in the industry are excited about, as well as managers, and that is gear switching, how trawl gear could be managed and monitored, rather trawl fishing can be transitioned to fixed gear, hook and line and trap, and how that process can be managed and monitored. And secondly, how these community-based cooperative organizations can work and what sort of benefits they may provide smaller-scale fishing communities like Morro Bay in this industry.
That's Janice.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to that as well that the thing we have to be very careful of is to make sure that it's understood that we're looking at something that's not going to just benefit Morro Bay. We're the experimental hub of it, but it's something that can have long-range impacts, good impacts, for the whole fishing industry. And also that it is a cooperative between an environmental organization and a commercial organization. And our county leads the way in these kind of cooperative efforts, this being one of them. And I think it's something that we have to all be very conscious of and push when we're asked about this to let people know, you know, this is a cooperative thing that we're trying to do for the betterment of the whole fishing industry and the environment at the same time. So that's what we have to highlight, that it's not, we're not trying to make our fishermen better than others or have better advantages. We're trying to improve the whole fishing industry in an environmental way and cooperative way. So that's the thing that we have to, when other people ask us about it and when we talk about it to other groups, we just have to promote that idea that this is cooperation between some areas that sometimes don't have cooperation. You know, this is a good thing, and it's going to be good in the long run for the whole industry.
Janice, I hope you can remember that soundbite for the council meeting. It's perfect.
I'm working on it.
So, Dean, why don't you go ahead?
Well, no, Henry, did you want to add something to that?
Well, yeah, because I think I forget more readily than you do. One of the very important components of the EFP is through the Magnuson Stevens, the Pacific Fisheries Marine Council is supposed to lead this change or shepherd this change to a quota-based management as opposed to an open access. And part of what we're trying to do is to help inform them how that can move. So part of the experiment is to provide information, to feedback, to cooperate on this level, as Janice pointed out, and gather data here and provide that back to the feds to help them make the make that transition in an intelligent way.
And did you indicate that this is just a 1 year exemption that you're seeking to try this out, and you feel like in 1 year you can get figured out how this is going to work?
Well, with every exempted fishing permit, there's usually an expectation that the proponents will go for an extension in following years. But you're only given an approval for 1 year at a time. So the moment we got an approval here, we have to do two things. One, kick off the experiment, and two, start writing the second application for a following year.
Dean, do you know anything about that process?
You mean running to stand still?
Yes.
No, I think this is a fantastic opportunity for the community, and I've got a bunch of questions that I don't think would be necessarily appropriate right now because I know we have a lot to do. But I just want to speak out in support of this because, as Mayor Peters said, I think it's a unique sort of collaboration, again, between conservation organizations and commercial fishing organizations. And I really think that this is the creative sort of solutions that the Marine Interest Group is striving to support. And so I think that coming forth with a letter of support for this is ideal, and I'd like to know what exactly we're supporting, though, first. Just so real quickly, what is it that in this process are we – so we're supporting your application to the Fisheries Council to try this experiment?
Yes.
Okay. And how – do you – if you could, might comment for me real quickly on – I assume this includes Port St. Louis.
Yes, it does.
We always say Morro Bay, but we really mean
That's okay.
the area.
I'm used to that.
equal rights for Port St. Louis, right?
That's why I'm here.
How is a new organization going to form? Because right now there's two separate fishing organizations, and obviously we're going to have these folks are going to have to come together and form one organization that then is going to allocate the quota over what spatial scale? Like, where does it? Where do they fish? What's their area? So those are a couple questions, real quick.
Go ahead.
Well, the area that we're targeting right now is the north of Conception and south of 36 degrees.
And seaward of 150 fathoms. So deeper than 150 fathoms, which is the outside line of the RCA.
Right.
Yeah. And in terms of another organization, we've already formed a community-based fishing association, which is a precursor to the regional fishing association, which is going to be designated by the PFMC. So we've already got the sponsors have been working really hard and collaboratively for months now, and the CBFA has already been formed.
And who's going to be on that decision-making body that's going to allocate the quotas?
There are seven people involved, seven groups. The Commercial Fishing Organization of Morro Bay, Commercial Fishing of Port St. Louis, the Port Morro Bay Harbor Department, Port St. Louis Harbor District, the Nature Conservancy, the Environmental Defense, and Fish and Game. We have a letter of interest out right now that lists inviting commercial fishermen to participate in this, and we list some milestones. We don't have all the answers yet because we won't know until the until November if it's approved, and if so, what parameters. And we have a backup model of policy that should it get more complex, we have some model policy in place on how we would go through an evaluation process and award fishing.
And so did you mention NOAA Fisheries
No.
person? But there's Fish and Game, but not...
Correct. Mm-hmm. Because, again, the idea is the community-based fishing association.
So just to add to that, Kirk explained it really well, and I think it's important to point out that we don't have all the answers, as Kirk did, and we'll have six fishing participants here, and how they're involved in the decision-making of the committee still needs to be decided. And I think that's a really interesting component of all this. I mean, and that's what we're tasked to do if we get the approval, is to start thinking about, okay, how does a community-based harvest co-op like this work? How is the fishing interest involved in decision-making?
Are there examples of this on the East Coast, of this kind of model?
Yeah, the best example is the Cape Cod Hook and Line Co-op. And actually, their president, Paul Parker, it will be here tomorrow night. And he'll be visiting with Kirk and with Rick and with Henry and some other folks here and some of the fishermen here. And we have a lot to learn. We can have a lot to learn from them. We've also got some help from a guy by the name of Joe Sullivan, who's a marine attorney, and he's helped establish some of the bigger and more successful fishing co-ops in Alaska. And the Pollock Co-op is one of those.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, I guess I'd like to sort of call the question, as it were. I haven't heard anyone who doesn't support this yet, so I guess I'd make a motion that we ask maybe Kirk and Rick and Henry to work together, the MIG members who are actively involved in this process, to put together a letter of support from the MIG, and I guess just ask that it get circulated around to the rest of us. But I'm ready to sign on to what I've heard this evening.
Okay. I'm wondering if we might just take a moment, and I'll try to just capture maybe some of the key things that people are noting as benefits, or what key points you'd like to make, maybe especially folks that, you know, in addition to the expertise that Henry and Kirk and Rick and Janice bring to this, because and Michael, because you've been so intimately involved, but sort of those of you that are kind of listening to this, you know, what are you kind of from a little more arm's length thinking about as benefits of this that I might jot down, so when we're framing this, we're kind of capturing, you know, what you're reflecting on. Deborah, what's coming to your mind?
Well, I think this is an opportunity to demonstrate how you can move from what's historically been such an adversarial relationship to building a more cooperative program. It's the first positive move that I've heard to move from long line, from trawling, from this adversarial environmental versus fishermen, to something that's going to be truly cooperative and actually coming to terms with the devil in the details, with actually figuring out how to make it work to benefit everybody.
Okay. Comments from others about key things that you're seeing. Ray, some thoughts, reactions?
No major action. I think it's a great idea, and I'm fully supportive. No other questions?
I guess I think the component of it, of having the local cooperative and local decision-making, you know, that's and local, I mean, I guess maybe I hope I'm understanding it correctly, but having, you know, fish allocated to this local region and local fishermen working together to figure out how to make that happen, that seems like something that resonates really strongly with things the MIG has been talking about for years, is this issue of we have local fisheries resources here being managed at this scale that's really out of proportion to the local environment and the local fishing community. And so I think the fact that this is really moving towards having this really regional, locally based fisheries management decisions being made, I think, is something the MIG has been behind for years.
Okay. How do you, maybe you could elaborate a little bit, Michael, on your comment about these community-based fishing associations and then how PFMC envisions these rolling up into some regional efforts. Do you have any more information or any perspectives about when they're saying something like this might roll up on a regional basis? What would regional mean to them, and anything about how that regime might look?
I think a lot of that still needs to be decided, and that's why I think there's great interest in this proposal. As far as what sort of role they see a regional fishing association playing, I think it's more what they're interested in. Some things are sharing costs. For example, there will always be some sort of monitoring cost for fishing within the ground fish industry, whether that's electronic monitoring, whether that's human observer coverage. There's an opportunity for fishermen to share costs. There's an opportunity for fishermen to share access. In the future with quota, you may need to hold a permit. Well, perhaps that permit could be held by one of these co-ops, and then there's a fisherman that's busy up north crabbing for part of the year, doesn't need access to the ground fish resource, but someone else may be able to use it in that time frame, and then you can sort of switch off. So that's something that folks are interested in. Also, depleted species. as it's conceptualized now, quota holders in the future would get some allocation, a small allocation, of how many depleted species they could take over a course of a year. There's an opportunity to share those sort of depleted species quota. Also share information. Fishing in one area may have a greater rate of catching canary rockfish than some other area. And if fishermen are working together, they can help each other out by saying, you know, stay out of this one spot because the canaries are really hot there.
Mm-hmm. So canaries there, being one of the examples of a threatened species.
Yeah. And the final thing, and probably the biggest reason that folks are interested in it, is that the more remote and small-scale fishing communities like Morro Bay, like the other ones here in the Central Coast, like Port San Luis, Moss Landing, Half Moon Bay, when fisheries do get transitioned to quota management, there is typically a consolidation of quota into the hands of the processors and into the hands of the bigger players in the industry. For us in the groundfish industry in the West Coast, that's up north. That's in Northern California and in Oregon. This is an opportunity for smaller communities that are on sort of the outskirts of the industry, if you will, to pull together some resources in order to keep their quota and to keep their access to the groundfish resource. And that's a very important and potential benefit of these regional fishing associations.
Okay, great. Dean, did you have some perspectives about?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a perspective that when I listened to the discussion, it reminds me again of this community being involved in something that is new and novel and trying to take resource management to another level and provide some new information that's going to help other areas and help us better manage our resources into the future. And so I think it's great that it's happening here in Morro Bay, this, you know, and Port San Luis. And in San Luis County, this, you know, small community, again, for whatever reason, is becoming an area where there's really interesting work happening. And I think that's where we want to be, because we want to tell people, this is what we've learned, this is how we should do it. That benefits us a lot, because we get to create the future instead of being subject to what someone else has created.
Okay, any other observations about key points that you'd like to have this letter of support include?
I had a question for Mike. When he was talking about, when you were talking, Mike, about the consolidation of the quotas, did you say that the quotas could be consolidated to the processors?
That is still in play, but processors will be able to own quota, yes.
They will be able to own quotas.
Yes, and they will more than likely be allocated some share on the front end of the transition.
Hmm. I know that's been a controversial issue, and I didn't know how it was being resolved. There was some discussion of a study that was done in New Zealand regarding the consolidation of quotas to the processors, and the fishermen didn't fare very well under those circumstances, and so I'm interested in following that particular issue.
Yeah, it's very controversial right now, and there's no clear answers. Sure, the fishermen would like to see about 10% go to the processors. Processors obviously would like to see a lot more.
Rick, something to add?
Yeah, Don, I was happy just to hear all this conversation. I was just not going to add, but there, I think maybe one thing I wanted to put in at this point is that this truly is a pioneering project, and that's exciting, but there's an old saying about what happens to pioneers, too, and there's a lot of risk to this, too. There's this is not just, you know, I don't want to get anybody's expectations that this is going to be a easy fix, even if it's granted. It's going to be very expensive. There's a lot of side costs out of the conditions with this. There are those in the community that think this will be very divisive, even amongst fishermen, with some people selected somehow in a process that will potentially grant them greater access. There's just so much work and so much difficult. There's a lot of risk here. some potential benefit in the long run. It's worth doing, but I don't want to deceive people that this is going to be some panacea next year or something. This is a long term. Next year, the opportunity that will come of this is really pretty small in terms of benefit support. It's all the other things that could be built out of it, and there's a lot of hard work and risk along the way. Thank you.
Okay. Any other observations about this? Okay, is it the consensus of the Marine Interest Group to support this EFP application before the Pacific Fisheries Marine Council? Okay, so with that, we'll get help from Kirk and from Henry on the Marine Interest Group, and I'll coordinate with you, and we'll get a letter featuring these points and other salient things that came out of tonight's discussion into a letter to go off to PFMC to support that. And good luck. Sounds like the right thing to do. It sounds like certainly the wave of the future is sort of what we've all been working towards, which is how to really manage in a sensible way these resources. And it'd be wonderful to have this next piece of that puzzle come into place. So hope you can be successful in every way possible.
You know, it's even very satisfying and rewarding to see that MIG itself has moved into this direction, because there have been times and days when MIG was very much divided on these issues, and this just at this local level, just at this table, it's very satisfying to see the consensus being built here. Thank you, Don.
Sure, welcome. Thank you. Now, you know, recognizing that thousands of people are watching this through the cable, TV, and so on, is there anything further in addition to this letter that either individuals of the Marine Interest Group or individuals in the community can do to mobilize themselves, friends, and others to support your initiative? This is going to be at the PFMC meeting held in...
It'll be at the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting held in Del Mar, yes. San Diego.
Okay.
And from November 4th to November 6th, the full council will consider it on November 6th. That's Tuesday.
This issue on November 6th.
That's correct.
Okay.
And demand locally caught fish from your retailers and your restaurateurs. Ask where the fish came from.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All U.S. right. caught, number one. Pacific caught is number two in priority, and locally caught would be the top, the other way around, top priority. But you want fish caught by U.S. fishermen. You want fish caught by on the Pacific coast. Or
maybe you need to have
fish.
One of those little wallet cards, you know, about what to ask about your fish.
That's a very good idea. That's a very good idea. Have a wallet card, because I always ask when I go into a restaurant, where did this fish come from? And I let them know my displeasure if it's not local fish, and so usually they see my displeasure, because I don't find that a lot of the restaurants in our area are supporting our local fishermen.
Uh-huh.
But I eat it anyway.
Okay. Did you have something else, Michael?
I have an update on a related but different project.
Okay.
When we conclude.
Sure. Well, I think we've got the action item here. We'll get this letter off. For it to be timely, the letter needs to be out by?
That's a great question. To be in the council material that will be handed out to everyone in the meeting, it needs to be delivered by the 30th of October.
Okay, so it's by next Tuesday.
Yeah.
All right. So this is something to get done this week. Okay. All right, good. Thank you for all your work on that. What's your update on the other related topics?
Well, and thank the community. I mean, it's really been an amazing process. It's far from a nature conservancy project anymore. It is really a large collaboration, and it's been wonderful to be part of it and to watch it all come together. So the other thing, the conservation fishing agreement, which is a project that we also presented to the MIG some months ago. And the background on this project, again, with six of our permits, we're doing this exempted fishing permit proposal. And that is what's going to the council in November. With our seventh permit, we have entered into a restricted leaseback to a local fisherman, Ed Ewing, who's agreed to fish this permit under certain conservation restrictions. And those conservation restrictions focus on geographic areas, monitoring protocol, and gear type. The reason that we are taking one permit and leasing it back to a trawling operation really lies in the how the industry functions. The groundfish fishery here on the West Coast is a multi-species fishery. There are 83 fish species associated with this fishery. Some of those are called flatfish and can only be commercially harvested through trawl gear. Fortunately, that trawl gear can operate in sandy and mud surfaces, places that have already seen trawl pressure, and effectively catch Petrolli sole, Dover sole, Rex sole, species like that. So we are trying, as we try to transition a lot of traditional trawl effort to more selective, less habitat impactful gear types, we're also making an effort and accepting the fact that, trawl does need to remain, some trawl does need to remain to catch these flatfish, and working with fishermen, collaboratively with fishermen, to try to find the best ways to do that. So it's really an experiment in trying to develop best management practices for trawl fishing. That project finally got underway. It's been about a year in the working. And Ed Ewing went out for his first fishing trip Monday. It was completely unsuccessful. The gear didn't work, the problems with the vessel, but it still was his first day of fishing. And that made us go out and do a press release, as large conservation organizations do. And that press release went out today, so there's a chance we'll see something in local papers tomorrow. And I have copies of the press release here for people's review and distribution.
Do the problems he encountered seem surmountable?
They do. Okay. They were well expected.
Okay.
It's the first time this vessel has been in the water for a long time. It's the first time that Ed Ewing's been in the water for a long time.
He was on the water, not in it.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that right? Or did he go
correct.
In the water? Was that part of the
water.
Problem?
Yeah, that's correct. And it wasn't. It was not. Ed's done an incredible job here, and he's been wonderful to work with. We are trying some new gear that has just been constructed over the summer. So there were some problems with that. There was also a very stiff current from these northeast winds that have been blowing for over 3 or 4 days. So there were problems that I think are all surmountable.
Okay. And this gear is intentionally created to have less impact, so less bycatch.
This gear is based on gear that has been tested in other places off the West Coast. It is called selective flatfish gear. It's designed to try to have a smaller impact on these sandy and mud surfaces where it will be deployed, as well as more selectively target flatfish that he'll be fishing for.
Okay. So if, as he's successful, we'll see more Petrolli sole in local markets and restaurants.
Yeah, that's a really great thing about this. Ed went out there and I think got some help from Henry, who's been pounding the pavement on this cause as well, and found all local markets for the fish that he anticipates catching, which is, we think, is just, you know, a wonderful thing that he's done. So
will there be a little notice at these places so people can read your good story and know that they're doing something valuable by buying this?
Henry?
That's a great idea, Don. I'll adopt that. We very much hope so. I mean, I think that a lot of it is going to rest on the community as well to go into local establishments and ask where the fish is from. We have to start making the connection of what we're eating and where it's from, and that's going to be part of the it's going to be part of our it's been identified as a major component of our marketing push.
Okay. All right, great. Any further questions about this other element of the initiative?
I'm ready to go door to door.
You're ready to go door to door with the fish?
No, with the signs.
You know, actually, it's very interesting because in other parts of the country, there is still a tradition, I think, particularly around the Boston area, where fishermen, or at least fishmongers, people who sell fish, actually still go through neighborhoods with, you know, their vans and sell the fish in the neighborhoods. It's something that's kind of never, I've not seen in California, but... Pardon me? Okay. All right. Well, our next topic here, thanks a lot, Michael, and everyone who's worked on that project. Our next topic here is about environmental conditions of Central Coast harbors. And to describe that, we have Karen Wooster from the Regional Water Quality Control Board. And we're really interested in looking, hearing your report. It's been an ongoing interest. One of the five key initiatives of the Marine Interest Group has been around water quality. Some people have likened, you know, the water to be like human blood in the human system. It has to be fresh, it has to be clean, and it has to work effectively to be successful. So we're really interested in hearing what you have to say about what you're learning.
Thanks, Don. Can you all hear me? I manage our Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program for the Water Quality Board. And our program has primarily focused on gathering watershed and coastal river mouth information, the loading to the ocean. But on occasion, we have funding or find funding to do more or less special studies at this point. And this is one of them that we put together. Actually, the work was done in 2004. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about this and mention one other study that you might be, actually a couple of other studies you might be interested in looking at on our website. I'll be pretty brief, for instance. It's really an amazing level of detail. My program took advantage of that to basically piggyback some funds on that and look at the remaining five harbors in our region. So our region goes pretty much from southern San Mateo down through Santa Barbara. So that would include Santa Cruz, Moss Landing, Monterey, Morro Bay, Port San Luis, and Santa Barbara. And the funds for that came from the state program that my program is primarily funded through, which is the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. So these are the sites that were placed in Morro Bay, 30 randomly selected sites for looking at water column and sediment chemistry. And then in addition to that, they did six trawls for fish tissue chemistry, and you can see those, the black lines represented there. And then there were also two muscle tissue sites. In Port San Luis, there were six randomly selected sites, which are the blue dots. And then the little lighter blue squares are the muscle sites, and the two dark lines are the fish trawls. Now, the fish trawls and the muscle sites were not placed randomly. They were a targeted site selection.
Karen, yeah. Can I comment real quick?
Sure.
My only comment so far. There will be others, is that the pier that says Unical Pier, that's actually the Cal Poly Pier.
It's an old map. Talk to USGS.
You had to search that out, do you? I can't see it.
Very good point. Just interesting when you look at the placement. I'll show you the other harbors, too. Just the nature of the different harbors. This one, of course, is much more open and spread out. And the area that we looked at, we actually, if you look at the definition of the area, I think it goes farther than between the two piers. The Kurt can answer this, but we actually confined it because we were really interested in the area surrounding the activity more. So most of the other harbors are a lot more confined. And also, again, Morro Bay, because the intent was not a harbor study, it was an estuary study. So there's a difference there, too, in terms of site selection, because it is not only looking at the harbor area, but it's going up into the whole bay. So what we did water column chemistry for nutrients, chlorophyll A, some basic physical parameters and light attenuation. We looked at sediment chemistry for metals and a suite of organic chemicals, butyl tins, and several other parameters that help us understand that. amphipod toxicity. So basically, that's where you take a test organism, take a sample, put the test organism in the sample, and see how well it survives in laboratory conditions. Fish and muscle tissue chemistry for some of the same kinds of chemicals. And then we also looked at benthic and faunal communities. This is the way most of the graphics are displayed in the report. And I'm going to take just a minute here to familiarize with it. Is there a pointer? That would be great.
Pointer? Laser pointer?
Can you see?
In the middle of the cookie.
Okay, these are from north to south, and these would be the six sites from Santa Cruz, Moss Landing, Monterey, Morro Bay, because they're special, Port San Luis, and Santa Barbara. Okay, this happens to be dissolved oxygen. In this case, we've got a couple of guidelines here. This higher guideline at 5 milligrams per liter is one we use to protect in the ocean environment. I'm not sure what EPA guideline that is, but that's way low. So you can see most of the Morro Bay sites were well over the guideline, as were the Port San Luis sites. And you can also see in some of the other harbors, this one, Santa Barbara, for example, has some circulation problems, and you can see that here. One thing I want to point out is that these studies are done during the middle of the day, and sometimes you might see problems. Oh, wait, they're not. I'm lying. No, that's surface and bottom. If you were to take oxygen measurements in the middle of, or say, early dawn, before you get a lot of sunlight, we might see some. In fact, I think the volunteer program does show some oxygen problems in the Back Bay. But this was the middle of the day, and it compares pretty favorably to some of the other harbors.
Karen?
Yeah.
Just to clarify, with oxygen, you want to be above the limit, above
right.
those dashed lines. So that's good for Morro Bay and Port San Luis are above. For a lot
right,
of the,
good point.
A lot of the graphs, it's bad if you're above.
Good point.
It's, looking
it's the shallows in the Back Bay. There's probably a wind activity and so forth, and you're getting things are stirring up. You're getting more turbidity in the water column. But generally compares similarly to other enclosed harbors, and you can see Port San Luis is quite a, generally pretty low, which you'd expect in a more open ocean site. It's interesting. When you looked at the water quality parameters, so these are all taken using probes from the surface. Generally, Port San Luis and Morro Bay had good water quality. The only sites that did not rate good in Morro Bay were for slightly elevated orthophosphate and water clarity. And Port San Luis, I think, was entirely rated good. You can see some of the other harbors had quite a bit of, for example, Santa Barbara really has some circulation issues in this enclosed area, and often in these back parts of the harbors where they're somewhat enclosed, Moss Landing, there's some problems showing up. Then we looked at chemistry and sediment, and this is where really having the context from the different harbors is very helpful, I think. You can see we have two criteria here called ERLs and ERMs, effects range low and effects range median. And these levels are a NOAA number that basically are derived for marine sediments, and the low level is the level at which 10% of tests typically show an environment a toxic effect, and the median is where 50% of the tests show a toxic effect. So
these are assays with organisms?
Yeah. Okay. This is a do the amphipods die in the petri dish test, right? So copper, which can be pretty toxic, you can see we actually had some exceedances of copper in Morro Bay. Now, copper is not nearly as high as some of the other harbors. Copper can be found in stormwater runoff. It's not an uncommon pollutant, from automobiles, for example. But also notice that it is showing this trend of increasing towards the back of the bay. And we see that pattern over and over and over in the metals data for Moore Bay. And one thing we know about the watersheds in this county in particular is we have a lot of metals associated with serpentine soils. And I'm not sure if that's what this is with copper. Frankly, it's I need to look that up. But I do know that you'll see some other patterns. Let me just show you. This is chromium. Chromium and nickel are the big ones, and aluminum, some other ones that you see here, Port St. Louis. You know, we've done sediment samples up and down the entire coast and seen it's just a standout area for these metals because of the serpentine soils. And Moore Bay actually was listed as impaired for metals, and I think it's been proposed for delisting because it was determined that the metals were not anthropogenic. They were just part of the geology of the area. They had done some coring and looked at metals concentrations in older sediments, pre-war sediments, because there were some mines, chromite mines in the upper watershed during the war, World War II, and they found that those concentrations really aren't significantly different in those cores. So they're presuming that it's not changing over time, therefore it's presumed a natural phenomenon. But these, it's interesting because if you look at the levels that are deemed potentially a problem for test organisms, it's well above some of those levels. But you have to assume, just like plants, where you have a lot of local endemism with native plants and serpentine soils, presumably things are adapted to chromium and nickel around here. And actually, here San Luis has a few high ones too. So, interesting.
The amphipods aren't
adapted. Well, you're right. The test organisms are, right, they're not local amphipods, so.
Those numbers weren't actually from toxicity tests. Those are numbers that are set
chemistry by
NOAA based on the accumulation of tests that have been done in the scientific literature. So those weren't percentage of organisms that died.
Right,
those
that's
are standard.
True.
The levels are set based on toxicity tests, but those were just levels in the sediment.
That's right. But we will show you some toxicity tests, and we did have a little bit of a toxicity signal,
right,
which may come from that. Now, this is not showing up really well in the back. It's a little bit light in here. But basically, they came up with a way to score the sediment performance based on how many times it exceeded ERLs and ERMs. Now, one thing I should point about the ERLs and the ERMs is there aren't really that many. There's many chemicals that we can measure we don't have criteria for, which is really frustrating. But when you look at that, they came up with sort of a ranking system, and obviously these darker red areas in Monterey Moss Landing, some of them are 11 to 15 exceedances of ERLs, 3 of ERMs. So each time you add a non-detect, it adds the detection limits. So sometimes the detection, when even with a non-detect, your detection limit will be over a criteria. And also, in some people criticize the ERL for DDT as being very low, certainly relative to environmental levels that we see. So at any rate, I guess what I'm saying here is that we are seeing exceedance in Moore Bay of this criteria, the ERL. In some cases, that's at a detection limit, a non-detect. So we're not even measuring the chemical, but it's an artifact of the sampling. But you can also see that relative to other places, it's a really low signal. Look at Moss Landing, you know, Monterey, still a very relatively high. Also notice there's a break in the scale here. So the levels in Moss Landing are pretty notorious for being high for DDT. We did see some toxicity to amphipods at 3 of the 30 sites, so 10% of the sites. We showed some levels of metals. Copper, as I said, can be toxic, so it could be related to that. We don't have an analysis of there's ways to do an analysis of what's causing the toxicity, but it's pretty expensive. But we did see toxicity. And one thing you could do is pair that up with the actual data at that site and see if you can see what the possible chemicals are. We haven't done that in this case. From the tissue sampling data, one thing that we found was arsenic in most of the harbors, including Morro Bay. Arsenic levels at 4 of the fish
four stations where we collected fish exceeded screening values from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. Arsenic can be used as a wood preservative, so that's a potential source for that. Again, the other metals were high compared to other harbors, like we'd seen in sediment. And though 12.5% of the tissue samples rated poor, that still is the lowest rate we found in the study for any of the harbors. Also, in Port St. Louis, we saw PCBs, arsenic, and PAHs, which is a petroleum-related chemical. PCBs in the San Luis Creek area have been a longstanding problem in that creek, and in the nearshore waters off that creek, we've detected it in other types of tissue sampling we've done in that area. May have come from some of the tank farm fires, for instance, or we're not quite sure on what the source is, but we see it frequently when we measure tissue in that area.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Do you? These are fish that were caught in the bay.
Right.
Yeah. Did you guys do any offshore sampling to compare?
Not for this. There's
the only reason I say that is because a lot of those, I mean, the mussels, okay, they're going to be in the bay. But each of those other ones are temporary residents. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be moving in and out of the bay. And it'd be interesting to know if offshore, maybe we see 12.5%.
Right.
Of these kinds of metals, or 25%, or what have you, and so that there's some baseline that has nothing to do with the bay at all.
Right. It's an interesting question, and you know there may be a data set out there that could be found that you could do that with. We have some data on popular fishing areas, so there was some beach data collected from a number of years ago. We could compare it to, so it would be like open coastline compared to harbors. But you know, there's no doubt that you find chemicals in fish samples in some places. In some places, it's worse than other places. So,
this is a quick follow-up on that, Dean. When in Slocy, you're doing the study of the otoliths or whatever on the halibut and so on. So you're kind of figuring out where they've been. Is there any way that you could correlate that with what you see in the tissues? In terms of these metals, to kind of say, okay, here's a fish that lived much more outside of the Morro Bay, and it had a profile like X, and then here's another fish that lived much more inside the bay, and it has a profile that looks like Y, and that might illuminate an answer to the question you're asking?
Well, I was going to say that they do, in the report, discuss the breakdown by the species, and I think it was the sand dabs that tended to be higher than the starry flounder or halibut.
That's so
the way I would answer that question is I would go and I'd get a species that whose juveniles develop in the bay and get the young fish that have been in there, and that's the only place they've been, and I would analyze those tissues versus ones that we know are offshore. I think that would probably answer that most directly.
Another really important factor is the fat content, because these are more the organic chemicals in the metals. It's all the organic in other harbors. And even after we fix the error in the data, not hugely lower, but lower. And one observation I want to make about it, but at the same time, the fish species diversity was higher. So one observation is that we are talking about an estuary here with freshwater influences, which may very well influence the type of community we're seeing here that maybe need to be more tolerant to more variable salinity, for instance. So it would be interesting to compare the Morro Bay data, and I imagine that the EPA study will do this, compare it to the other estuaries that it was sampled with. The other point is that it was sampled by a different group of people. So it could be that there were slight differences in the way the sampling was done, but it was just an interesting observation. I think it would be a good thing to look at maybe in a little more detail, because we have the community analysis, what species we found. Are they indicative of brackish water as opposed to straight marine water and so forth? So because the other harbors, I mean, Moss Landing is at the mouth of Elkhorn Slough, but it's generally much more marine, I'd say, overall than Morro Bay. That would be my guess. I don't know. Does anyone have an opinion about that? So this report is on our website at www.ccamp.org, Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. The other there's actually a number of reports there that might be of interest to you. All of the Seattle research that we've been involved with, the folks at Long Marine Lab, Fish and Game, and some of the Morro Bay related findings on toxoplasma are there. But also, there's a new report that's just been released on sea otter tissue bioaccumulation. And that was looking at, it was the same research group that's been doing the work on the pathogen problems and so forth, but looking at the concentrations in of chemicals in stranded sea otters and then relating that to what they actually died from and trying to see whether there are any relationships to some of the diseases that we've been seeing that we're concerned about. So in other words, are the chemicals causing some kind of a immune response problem? So it's an interesting study. They did find some associations between a couple of the chemicals, I think PCBs were one, and a couple of the pathogen problems. But it's a very complicated story, and they're doing some more analysis on the data, and they'll be publishing it. The other piece of the study that I found very interesting was one of the chemicals that popped out as relatively elevated in sea otter tissue, besides the standard set of suspects, which would be DDT, PCBs, PAHs. The other one was PBDE, and that is a byproduct of fire retardants, and it's kind of classified as one of the emerging chemicals of concern. It showed up, I think 5 or 6 years ago, there were some studies released in the Bay Area showing PBDE levels in harbor seals, remarkably high, and in women's breast milk, quite elevated. And then they started looking at time series, and they were seeing, multiple-fold increases. Was it 100-fold? It might have even been 100-fold. It was some extraordinary number over a 10-year period in harbor seals in the Bay Area, because it's a chemical that's used in making fabrics and things less flammable. Of course, it's used... I'm sorry? Right, which is an interesting thought from the standpoint of having children. It's an endocrine disruptor. And it has some... an endocrine disruptor, meaning it can... mimicking estrogen-type chemicals. But it also has some other effects. And I think they were neuro... At any rate, and I was trying to understand why, and the interesting thing about it, first of all, you tend to think of our area as so relatively pristine compared to the Bay Area, so even to find it by accumulating in otter tissues for me was really surprising. It was in higher concentrations in the southern part of their range, meaning down in this area, compared to the northern part of their range, which was also surprising to me. And I just happened on a website the other day where someone from Woods Hole was noting that it's also a natural byproduct of some forest fires. So this is, I have no idea if something like the Highway 41 fire could contribute PBDEs to Morro Bay, but it was an interesting paper, and it's something I think we might want to look at in more detail. I've actually been talking to Lars a bit about it because he's been looking at aragobies in the bay and some problems there. So,
Is it a byproduct of the fire or of what's dropped on the fire?
Well, that was why I was looking it up, because I was wondering if it was in the, when they bombed the fires, if it was part of that. So. This paper, I didn't find that. And when you start really looking at sort of what the levels are, say, looking at fish, say, in an open ocean environment, it would be just very an interesting comparison to see if we are seeing higher levels in harbors, because that might be something that, you know, change in the type of wood treatment we're using could help address. The copper, I think, is of interest. It is exceeding, in Morro Bay, it is exceeding the lower limit for sediment, and we know it is coming, it can be a stormwater pollutant. So it's something we want to keep our eye on and perhaps look at sediments in the vicinities of some of the, I think with a first flush monitoring program that the volunteer program runs, looks at copper. So we want to keep our eye on that. But the fact that it was fairly widespread and increasing as you go into the finer sediments in the upper bay makes me wonder if it isn't coming out of the watershed.
Is it a component of bottom paint?
Right.
I think it is.
And, yeah.
The DDT levels are, DDT is fairly pernicious.
And ubiquitous.
Can we tell by the change in numbers over time whether this is an older
yeah.
Substance or it's
you can look
still
at yeah I you can look at the ratios of the DDT to the breakdown forms, which are DDE and DDD, and that can give you some indication. So the DDE, I think the DDD is the oldest. I'm not sure we have the trend data in Morbay to do that. Well, you could look at the ratios right now, but in terms of older data, we have probably a few samples from the Muscle Watch program from the past. You could look at that. But it's interesting because we've looked at some of the DDT concentrations in, like, Santa Maria, where they're quite high, and there's a surprising amount of DDT still, which makes you wonder if there aren't some existing sources still, old barrels of them sitting around somewhere. But in places where we do have some capability to show really long-term trends, and one of the best spots we have is that Moss Landing Harbor, probably because it's about 50 feet from the old Muscle Watch office. They just drop their muscles out their back door. We have about a 20-year, 25-year record of tissue bioaccumulation there. And the most obvious thing that you can see, instead of a declining trend over time, is a relationship to large, like, El Nino storm years. So when the sediments are really getting stirred up and you're really getting things coming off the land, the mussels will all spike. And we did some sand crab work up and down the whole coast, and that was when we were seeing some really high levels in Santa Maria along the beach there. There are two interesting things about that. One was that when you compared it to a study that was done in the 70s in the same area, there was not really a significant decline. And the other thing that was interesting is you could see a gradient from the sand crabs collected near the mouth of the river going away on the beach. So it looked really like it was a, you know, river source still.
Okay, any other comments? So we're going to get a... Thank you very much, Karen.
I have one question.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I had to step out for a second, but did you find any evidence of pharmaceuticals at all? Because I know we've been looking at that recently, and
right.
I don't know if there's tests for it yet.
We didn't really, in this particular study, look for pharmaceuticals, and that is really specialized work and expensive. The suite of chemicals that EMAP uses and that we looked at was pretty conventional from the standpoint of organic chemicals and old mostly, and that's because they're easy to measure in tissue and sediment, and they're still there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, getting into things like aspirin and caffeine, and they're all specialized tests, they're quite expensive. And I know there was some work done back in the Los Osos area on groundwater, and there were some pharmaceuticals found mm-hmm. in those tests. But in terms of looking in the bay, I'd say maybe Lars Tomanek's project may be going there. Is that?
Yeah, well, he's not looking at the chemicals directly. What he's doing is he's taking tissues and indicator organisms, and this is Lars Tomanek at Cal Poly, and he is looking for characteristic responses of physiological responses of the organisms to the chemicals. So he's not looking at the chemicals directly, but if you know how the organisms respond to it, you can look at their tissues and say, hey, they're responding to this particular chemical. And so he's trying to do some work looking at aerogobies and also bivalves to look at a broader class of compounds instead of testing for the individual compounds.
Well, I love the report for Morbay's.
Puget Sound, Santa Monica Bay, and then Tillamook Harbor in Oregon, which is probably the most similar to us in terms of kind of size and scale, were quite a bit better than the estuaries, the national estuaries on the Gulf Coast and the Eastern Seaboard and Florida. And I think, but it's a little tricky just because both the physical scale and then the kinds of land uses and the history of use of these different harbors, we're much more rural. Most of the National Asteroid Programs are Puget Sound, New York, New Jersey Harbor, places that have just been incredible epicenters of industry for hundreds of years. And so you would expect to see a lot more pollution from all that use and from urbanization in those areas. So we fared pretty good in that context, but it's a context we're sort of have the upper hand in from the outset.
Okay, Karen was reporting on data from 2003 and 2004, and one of the main initiatives of SLOSEA is to look at water quality in the bay, and Dean Wendt is going to give a brief update about what we're starting to look at in 2007.
Okay. It's that one. And I'm not going to be really showing any data. I'm just going to give you an update on progress, although there are lots of data. So this is an initiative of the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, and this is run by Mark Moline at Cal Poly. He's the director of this particular project. And unlike what Karen showed, the data that we're going to be showing is not spatially extensive. What it is time intensive. And so we have launched and deployed two arrays currently in Morro Bay that are continuously monitoring water quality for seven different parameters. And I put a graph up from some of the data from early on showing things like salinity and turbidity as a function of tide at the Back Bay station here. And what you're looking at there is a solar panel with a battery pack and a cell phone telemetry system, and that's above water. And below water are the seven pieces of equipment that are monitoring the water quality. So we have one of these at the back portion of the bay here, BS1, right in the channel there. And then we have one outside of the harbor office by the Coast Guard up at the first teep here. And what I'm happy to report today is that we have just started today deploying the two stations that are going to get the signal from Choro Creek, and then an integrated signal from Choro Creek and Los Osos Creek, and you can do math to find out what's coming from Los Osos Creek if you have that composite station there. And so these are the parameters that are being collected every 15 minutes at the array. We have temperature, salinity, conductivity, depth, so that's the tide signal, oxygen levels, oxygen saturation, chlorophyll, so that's the amount of phytoplankton living, the plants living in the water, turbidity, and then we express nitrate in two ways here. It's just a conversion between micromoles and milligrams per liter. And these data are uploaded to our website every 15 minutes, and this image was taken from the website at about noon today, so this is a standard time that we use so that we can compare with people who are collecting real-time data at other places. So local time, this is about noon, and they're coming from this station and this station here. Anyway, I'm not really about showing data. I just wanted to say that this is part of our website, and you can log on and see these data. And there are going to be two more columns in pretty short order for these guys. And this is Ian Robinson and John Penven, who are out in the marsh earlier. And there's Ian. He's hammering a pole, and we have permits to do this, by the way, into the salt marsh. And he's jumping there to jump on a you can barely see it. There are these boards coming off of this pole to make sure that, when you mount on top of this a solar panel and the battery pack, and the telemetry system that a large wind won't blow it over. This pole is actually 6 feet underground as well, okay? And this one is the Marsh Station from Choro Creek, and this is going to be up in the marsh, and then there's going to be a tethered line that comes off of this. So the Slow to Sea website, and you click on either water quality as one of the initiatives, or you go to the dashboard, you can actually see these data from the first two stations being uploaded every 15 minutes. And this is very rudimentary right now. We'll put the other two stations up there. But where we're going with this is, this is going to be a portal for people to access and query databases to make graphs of parameters that they're interested in over time. Maybe there's a rain event that happens and they want to see what happened. So you can actually do some graphing right there on the website. But then we're also, and we'll have a more extensive dashboard that has gauges for certain parameters that you can see at the different stations. But then we want to have a completely queryable database so that people can actually download data and utilize that for asking particular questions of interest. And this might be people at the Water Quality Board or people at another institution like Cuesta College that would have an interest, or other researchers and the like. So this is just, you know, it's been a long time coming. It feels like it. It's only been a year. January 1, 2007 was when we got our first bit of data from the first array in the Back Bay, and so you know, it's taken a few months, but we're now getting the last two in, and so we're pretty excited about that. And the big difference between what the estuary program does and what Karen was talking about is that this is not as spatially expansive, but it's very resolved in terms of time. So we have a lot of data that's being taken all the time, and this information will then be used ultimately to understand the dynamics of the bay, because you can then, if we have good bathymetry maps, which we're getting, and we have these parameters, you can start to model how the water moves in the bay. And that's where we're really heading with this, and trying to get grant support actually to develop that model and work with people who have that expertise to really start to look at how water moves around the bay and how it flushes, and if you were to have a source of some pollutant, how that would spread in the bay and be moved by the tides and influenced by various factors in the bay. So that's where we're going with this long term. And when I say that, I mean over the next several years. Anyway, so that's what Slow Sea is doing, and that's the latest update on the work that's been transpiring.
Are you going to link in with what Dan was describing earlier about this dye study with the oysters and so on? That sounded like an interesting thing, that they're trying to put some dye in and see where the water moves. It seems like a natural linkage with what you're...
Yeah, Dan and I talk on a pretty regular basis, and surprisingly, it's the first I've heard of it.
Yeah, well, that was why I mentioned it tonight. It's really something that we just heard about this week. It's something that... Department of Health Services is interested in doing because of their interest in water quality in the oyster beds, trying to understand what's where the source of high bacteria numbers are there. So they're talking about it. I think that the dye tracking study is, if it comes at all, it's going to be kind of a ways off just in terms of the process to put that together. They've just been contacting us, putting together a list of who should we start talking to about, and Slow Sea is definitely on the list because I think it could be really applicable to Mark's interest in, and this overall interest in, better circulation models in the bay. And it may be the kind of thing, if they're already going to do it in one part of the bay, we may want to talk to them about how we could sort of leverage off that and do a larger study as well.
And you know, so that's the, anytime you build a model, you want to ground truth it, and that's exactly how you would ground truth the model. So there would be working with the model and then doing empirical work, science, to figure out if your model is actually predicting what you think it's predicting, how useful it is. So
sounds like a great opportunity.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you. Any questions or comments on this item? Okay, coming up next here is the response from the Fish and Game Commission to the MIG petition on owl limpets. You recall at the June meeting of the Marine Interest Group, in response to comments from the community about concerns with regard to poaching or about the levels of legal take that could be happening in the Rocky River Tidal area, the Marine Interest Group formulated a petition to the Department of Fish and Game and the Fish and Game Commission, requesting that there be a study on their part and action taken to restrict the takes from these fragile rocky intertidal areas, especially the new ones being opened up through the Hearst acquisition, the Estero Bluffs, et cetera, which are creating some public access to areas that are very...
I'm an associate professor at Cal Poly Center for Coastal Marine Sciences in San Luis Obispo. I want to thank the commission for giving us time on the agenda, and I want to thank the department staff for responding very thoughtfully to our petition. And I also want to thank the staff for the amount of time that they devote to our community in San Luis Obispo and the Morro Bay and Port San Luis region, in particular the activities of Deb Wilson Vandenberg, Debbie Hazeltine Nielsen, and then also Christine Pattison. Today I'm here representing the Marine Interest Group in the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance, and I am really representing a community-based effort, and I'm going to try to provide you a little bit of background about how this grew and has come before you. So the Marine Interest Group, very briefly, is a multifaceted group of elected officials, scientists, business people, fishermen, conservationists, academics, and local residents whose goal is to sustain the marine resources in our area. And the San Luis Obispo Science and Ecosystem Alliance is...
We will note, though, that Dean has an alternative vest to wear with his three-piece suit.
Hello. Okay. That's nice. All right. I'm getting picked on here. It's good.
No.
It's more than just a different vest. It's a different tie, a different jacket.
Very
the
good.
Resolution wasn't good. You couldn't see the pattern on the tie.
Yeah, there we go.
Anyway. Oh, ooh, well, that was as painful. That was more painful than sitting there for 8 hours watching that for, 80 seconds. Anyway. So what happened, the long and short of it, is I went up and presented the letter from this group and made the arguments that this group made, and then the department argued very strongly against us. and I can summarize real quickly. You've probably seen their letter, but the arguments that they made were that essentially... The owl limpet's low priority on their list. They have limited funds. It's ninth on their priority list or something like that, and so there's really no way they can deal with it. There's no creel census or current data on amount of fishing intake, so they have no idea what to adjust the bag limits to. They talked with their wardens and surveyed the wardens, who said that poaching is really not an issue for this organism. And they said that with the enactment of the new marine protected areas and the new marine reserves, that they thought that was sufficient for protection of this species. And I just passed around a letter from an official letter from the commission that says, it doesn't even say thanks for coming. It says, it just says,
no.
That they didn't approve and they sided with the department. So there it is. I had some very good conversations with people at the department who were very respectful and nice to work with, and they agreed that this is something we need to go and get more information on. It was good to be up there and get on the agenda because, from what I could tell, the Fish and Game Commission hears a lot of things multiple times before any change is made. And the other thing that was, I think, particularly good for this group to know and the community to know is that we were publicly acknowledged by the commission as a group that is a model for what the state should be doing and what communities should be doing. And they actually, you know, said the Marine Interest Group is a fantastic organization, and this is roughly quoted, and that, you know, this is what other communities in California should be doing. And so that was good to be up at the decision-making body, you know, for the California Department of Fish and Game, and to have them say that to us. And so that's good.
I think in light of the time, we won't, but thank you for resolving that.
Wow.
So other comments about this?
Well, I would just notice, Dean, that as you introduced MIG, you jogged their memory very nicely, and it was a good introduction to the owl limpet issue, but you jogged their memory very nicely as to who MIG is, right. And it was very helpful.
Okay.
There you go.
I was going to say, I just think it's I'm not too discouraged particularly, but I think it's sort of a ironic or unfortunate circumstance to have the commission on the one hand say, this is great, this is what folks should be doing everywhere, getting together and coming up with these ideas, but, sorry, it's not particularly, it's nice to hear, it's not particularly inspiring maybe for other organizations to want to put the effort in, if that's going to be the final result, is sort of the thanks but no thanks. But I think you're right that, for better or worse, the commission seems to move slowly on most things. So
yeah.
A first introduction to it may just be that.
I've got to say also that I have to admit that I think we were a bit naive and ambitious in all of this, in that what I've learned is that there's a lot of dialogue that has to happen with the department staff before you go in front of the commission. It's kind of like writing a grant proposal to a foundation that you've never had a conversation with before, and the program officer has no idea who you are. There's a dialogue that has to happen before you ever get there, and sort of the ducks have to be in a row. And what I also learned is that, and we all know this, the department is just overwhelmed. And when the Fish and Game Commission says you need to do something, that taxes their resources. And since this is ninth on their priority list, the commission looks at it and just says, well, there's no way, even if there is a problem, there's no way we can ask them to do something and to do the research that it would take to change these bag limits, because there's eight other things, six of which they can't even get to. And so I think what the key is, you have to change the priority list, you know, to get something acted on. But again, we're learning as we go.
I'm at this location where they are giving your comments on your section.
I think we'll have to just pass on that for now, but thanks. I think one of the comments I make about this is that, yes, it's sort of nice to be recognized, and also, you know, what traction did we get? And it's bringing to my mind that I think that there's the next stage for the Marine Interest Group and for the Sustainable Fisheries Project and the regional stewardship and so on, is that the next opportunity for us, if we're interested, is to really figure out how can we create, if you will, sort of a regional stewardship council. How could we, instead of trying to throw all these things to Sacramento and hope that they hit and then they have no chance and, you know, and all this sort of frustration, How could we really start to implement what the Pew Commission report, the U.S. Ocean Commission's report, what everybody's talking about, and what the Magnuson-Stevenson Act is talking about, of trying to figure out effective regional management? And maybe it takes a different structure. Maybe it takes a way that there are folks who are more better understand the resources locally and figure out how to manage them to be taking more of a role in that. And that might be something that if the Marine Interest Group has an interest, I think there's an evolving interest on the part of the regulatory folks and others to figure out a way to support us in helping that happen. And that might be ultimately the way it goes, because trying to get everything through the eye of the needle of the Fish and Game Commission, when they're also figuring out, you know, how many deer should be, you know, allowed to be hunted in the year, and, you know, a Humpty squat, other issues, is just never going to happen. But I think that next generation of a regional stewardship kind of concept might have some traction, and we might be able to be a model for that, just as you're trying to be a model for community-based fishing associations. So anyhow, I don't despair about it, but I think we have to look at what's a new way of, what's a way to reinvent how these things get dealt with. And I think we've got some support for that if we want to go there. Okay, thanks, Dean, for going up there, devoting a whole day, more than a day. I mean, in terms of it's more than just 8 hours getting up there and back. That was just getting up there and back, and then it's the whole time of sitting there and waiting for your turn and everything else for doing that. Thank you. So we're now at a concluding piece here, and we want to talk about ongoing role for the MIG, topics for the next meeting. We'd be targeting, you know, three sessions next year, something probably January, February time frame, something again in sort of April time frame before the commercial fishing season opens up, and something again in the fall.
I think you're right that, you know, both the fishing, the Nature Conservancy, the collaborative fishing effort, and those permits that we are going to take action on, and then again this issue with the owl limpets points to these, you know, challenges in how marine resources are managed and the scales at which they're managed. I think that's something we should continue to try and both to understand and then also to think about whether we can come up or be a part of some better models for that. You know, in terms of role, I think, frankly, I think we're doing pretty well in terms I see a central role as just bringing us all together, folks from these really different perspectives on marine resources, and I think getting us all together to talk about the governance, you know, the status of the resources, the environmental health out there, I think we're pretty much on the right track in terms of the role. But yeah, I think governance and regulatory structure and, you know, where that's working and where it's not working seem like obvious things for this kind of a group to talk about.
Okay. Kirk?
Don, I'm kind of intrigued by your earlier comment
about next steps. Microphone, please.
You bet.
How about that? Okay, thank you. I'm kind of intrigued, and what I would want to know is, what are the strengths of the MIG, and how do we distinguish ourselves from other similar groups? And then getting the answer to that could inform us about a leadership role we could play. Is it to integrate other similar groups as one example, or is it, if we're going to go to a regional base, what role could we play in that?
Yeah, I guess the over the history of the MIG, the last 4 years, has actually been sort of a mix of things. So in some instances, it's been a forum that has spawned some initiatives like collaborative research and slow sea. In other cases, it's been a forum to share information about different things that are happening so people can coordinate. It's sort of been multiple roles.
Right.
I don't know, is there something about the role that sticks out in your mind?
I would want to know how we could distinguish ourselves from the other groups and what we could offer in terms of integration or convergence.
Okay. Janice?
I know what I want to say, but I'm not sure what words to use to say it. Again, along the same kind of a line, getting more recognition for what this group is and what it does within our community and how it can be a voice of a combined group of stakeholders, if you will, that don't always have the same outlook but want to achieve good goals that we all share, and letting people know that. And maybe that's as simple as appearing at other organization meetings, even if there's not a specific topic we want to talk about, being there when we can, being a part of the group, making sure that they know who we are and what we're doing, perhaps even sending them letters saying, you know, this is something that the MIG is working on in our county right now, and this is how we stand on this issue. You know, we've been looking at our water quality, whatever the issue is, just to let the appropriate agencies know what activities we're involved in so that we become a recognized organization that next time we go to Fish and Game, maybe they'll say, oh, yeah, those guys are really active over there. We should pay attention. Mm-hmm. So something in just increasing our participation and communication with other agencies, perhaps.
Okay. Good. Carolyn?
I think I want to be a little bit more specific. I would like to see MIG help to implement the marketing program that's being developed for the sustainable fisheries effort. I think we all need to help get the message out there of community education, those kinds of things. It's going to take a huge effort, not just an idea.
Okay. Good. Thanks. Henry?
Yeah, I think Dan and Janice touched on the issues that I was concerned about, the issues that I felt were important.
Okay. Ray?
This might be, it's similar, but just maybe a slightly different twist. I think one of the things I've noticed over the course of some of these meetings is that agencies come and they tend to respect the science that's being done, but they don't necessarily incorporate it. And so I'd like to see us continue to push to have some of the decision makers accept the work that's being done here and for them to find ways to incorporate.
Adequately is public education. And I think that having seen the clientele as being the marine resource users, the tourists, I think the survey that Slow Sea sponsors, having public forums, I want to incorporate much of this into different classes at Cuesta, having a broadening a public awareness of the sustainable seas, of the ship to shore, having the ship to shore come and give a talk in the oceanography class. So the scuba divers would be a new support for this project. I think in that way we can get a broader support group to speak about the projects. And from there, I think this group could become more influential.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dean.
Yeah, I'm doing it. Thanks, I got you. I want to thank everybody for doing the thinking for me, because I think what people have said is all spot on. And I would just emphasize that I think our strength is the fact that we bring together these diverse interests and we operate from a point of consensus, and that when we write a letter, it really, I think it does mean something to people outside of this area. And so I think that's our real strength. That's what makes us unique, and we need to draw on that strength in that advocacy role for issues that are brought forward where we have consensus. And I think for us to be more efficacious, we need to begin to develop these links to the decision-making body. Somehow we have to, it's, and you've already said it, it's the translation of what we're doing to action. And so that's what I would say we need to, that's what our strength is, and that's what we need to focus on doing, is how do we get the ball down the field a little further.
Okay, so the theme of how do we get information into action, and do that with the governing bodies that are out there. And that's
right.
Sort of the key thing, whether it's the EFP or it's other topics. That's what we're really kind of coming up against. And that, interestingly enough, was out of the five initiatives that the Marine Interest Group came up with at the end of its first year of activity and the executive report that came out of that, that was one of the key things, was to figure out, okay, how could we work collaboratively to figure out better governance, because everyone's realizing there's this patchwork out there that isn't working. And we also had another key initiative out of that, which was how to support local fishermen and the market for local fish, which is something that you were mentioning, Carolyn. So some of these are actually ringing back to things that we were really at the core of what the MIG is all about. It sounds like good topics for us to come back to at our meetings in 2008. So any comments before we close? I want to thank you all for being here. Thank our viewers from outside and all the people who worked so hard in putting things together and presentations. We look forward to the continuing dialogue about these topics. And any closing comments from anybody?
I would just like to say, Don, I think we all need to thank you for the work that you've done. Okay. And, I mean, I don't know if everybody knows the amount of work that goes on outside of this to piece all of the pieces together, to line the speakers up, to make sure people are talking and groups are functioning. I mean, it's a big effort, and so I think that we owe thanks to you as well for everything that's happened and is happening in this community over the last several years.
Well, thank you very much. Okay, thank you all, and good night.